Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, MLNKG2C will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for the discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss the important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of the website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to live.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Malen, KG2C, will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. Last month, we did something a little special. We offered a pair of presentations on several aspects of software-defined radios and answered questions about it afterwards. These discussions are available on our archive. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know here or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Malen KG2C. Good evening, Malen.
Good evening, Roy, and everyone else on the net. This is Milan, Kilo Golf 2 Charlie. Looking forward to what we have tonight and the puzzle as well. Over to you, Roy.
Very good, Milan. So I will open the tech net for tonight by asking for people to submit their call sign and their first name if they have a question or a comment for the net. I appreciate people who check in to support the net, but primarily the most interesting are the people who would feel that they want to participate into the net. So please give us your call signs and your first name, and we'll put you on the list for questions or comments.
KD2KLN, Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Lima November. My name is Brian. I'm in Belleville, New Jersey, and I do have a question.
Very good, Brian. You are officially on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight?
Net Control, Kilo 2, Japan, Victor, X-Ray, Lloyd, and Gramercy Park.
Very good, Lloyd. Do you have a question or a comment for tonight?
Sorry about that. Question.
Okay, you are officially on the list. Anyone else out there want to put their name on the list for comments or questions for tonight? Okay, very well. We'll start with two. Sometimes people come a little late, and we'll give people an opportunity to check in later if they come with a question or a comment. And always keep in mind, we do have a puzzle tonight, as we almost always do. It's an illustration of a printed circuit board with a circuit designed on it. And question is what the heck that circuit design is called and what it does. So if anyone has a chance, please check the page. It's puzzle.kc2rc.com or the front page. There's a link to it in kind of orange. And please take a look at it, and later we'll all discuss it. So first on the list is Brian, KD2KLN. What's your question for tonight, Brian?
Hello, this is KD2KLN. Over the years, I have amassed a collection of rubber duckies. And I don't mean the kind that float in the tub with Ernie while he sings his song. I mean the type that you put on radios. A lot of them are generic, black, spirally wound somethings that terminate in some kind of BNC connector. They might have come off of a handheld CB radio. They might have come off of a handheld VHF marine radio. They might have come off of a handheld scanner. My point is, my problem is, and this is my question, I don't know which ones do what. And I need to kind of sort them out so that I can determine which ones to keep and which ones to throw away. So, basically, that is my question. How do I determine what frequencies are best, or what frequencies does that antenna service? I tried an SWR meter, and that was really not very helpful. My question for you is basically, how can I, I guess I'm going to need an antenna analyzer, but how do I determine which antennas service which frequencies?
Well, Brian, you sort of answered the question yourself. There's the clean way of doing it and the dirty way of doing it. And the dirty way of doing it is, as you mentioned, hooking it up either to an SWR meter or just hooking it up to a power source, running the power low, and seeing if you're being received by anyone, and making sure smoke doesn't start to come out of something. But seriously, ultimately, the best approach is to borrow someone's antenna analyzer and sweep the frequency range and see if there's any resonant dip in the band that you're interested in working. Now, it's not that obvious with rubber duckies because they are not the most efficient antennas in the world, and so you're not going to see a classic standing wave ratio drop, impedance drop, and it's not going to look like a dipole, but you might be able to infer a band that it works halfway decent for by using that method. Now all you have to do is go find someone with an antenna analyzer.
Hello, Golf Detroit.
Yes, Milan.
I have a somewhat easier, although more time-consuming method of doing this, because I also have, let's call it a pile of rubber duck antennas, and they literally sit as a pile. So when I grab my HD, I need to figure out which antenna to put on it. I kind of have to make a decision every time. One thing with new antennas that I've noticed, the ones from China that come with radios like Baofeng or TYT, all of them seem to have the frequency that they are supposed to support written on the connector itself. So if you orient the antenna so you're looking straight at the connector, you would see a range. For example, the antenna that came with my 70 centimeter radio says 400-800 megahertz. And that's one way to tell. The other antennas which I bought, like my Hipario antenna, has that written on the side right below the brand name. Now, not all antennas have that, and in those cases, it's helpful if you still have the brand name and the model written on the side, so you can at least Google that antenna and see, what it does. And for some antennas, after you do this, you just have to memorize which bands it's supposed to cover. And the third way is to try to remember which antenna came with which radio originally. And it's a fair assumption that antenna would cover the frequencies the radio was designed for. So if it's a 2 meter and 70 centimeter HT that came with it, you should assume that antenna can cover those two bands. And if the radio was only 70 centimeter, like my TYT MD380, that antenna was only for 70 centimeters and they did not bother including 2 meters, making it a dual band antenna when the radio itself was only for a single band. So those are the methods I use, and they're not scientific, don't depend on any other equipment, but do depend on you being able to spend some time identifying things. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
82 CBV comment.
Yes, Todd.
Well, my compliments to the net operator and the assistant net operator. Why, it's National Compliment Day. The one other thing is, to go ahead and scrap all the antennas and don't bother with them and get yourself some quality antennas and just use those antennas. When Malem was saying, oh, if you remember which antenna the radio comes, okay, fine. Since I operate off of several bands, 2 meter, 1.25, 440, 900, etc., I do have a variety of antennas. I also have a variety of antennas for different purposes. You know, some short, some long. And the thing is, I swap them all out on the same, you know, on all the same antenna on all the different radios I use. So that way I don't have to worry which is which. And yes, my antennas are marked at the base. I tend to prefer the diamonds because they perform. But that's another option, because some of the antennas, particularly those from China, some of them fall apart. If you sneeze on them, I'm not going to risk my radio on that, and I'll just have a good quality antenna and then move that around from radio to radio as needed. So that's another option, although I prefer to know what antennas I have, and I would prefer an antenna analyzer, so there is that too. But it's just another option, KB2CBV.
Okay, very good, Todd. I agree with you. It wasn't quite Brian's question of, you know, throwing it out and getting better antennas is always a nice option if you can afford it. I took a look through my collection of rubber duckies, and at least one, possibly two of them, has no documentation on any aspect of it of what band it's designed for, and those were probably ones that that came rather cheaply with my Baofeng. Fortunately, all my handy talkies are UHF, VHF, so all my little rubber duckies are also UHF, VHF. Some of them are SMA true, and some of them are SMA reverse, so sometimes you're not able to plug one into the other. So I don't really have anything like a 10-meter rubber ducky anyplace, because I have nothing that would fit it anyway. So all these are very good reasons, solutions to the problem. Does anyone else have any good solutions to this problem?
Kilo 2 Japan Victor X-ray, comment?
Yes, Lloyd, comment away.
You could just try to adapt the antennas to the device, to the transmitter, and just see what kind of, what the S-meter is saying. And when the S-meter peaks, that must be the right antenna.
Well, yeah, it's sort of a version of Brian's comment that he checked the standing wave ratio as well to get something with a low standing wave ratio, and it didn't seem to work for him at the time.
But I suppose, and maybe what I'm saying works better on HF antennas, but when you're messing around with antennas, and I guess a lot of UHF, VHF radios and certainly scanners might not even have an S meter, it's always good to... it might work. Again, it's an inexpensive solution. That's the advantage of it.
Yeah, but as you mentioned, it's much more obvious on the HF band. If you tune up your antenna, you can usually by ear tune it up close to resonance just by listening to the background noise and such on the frequency. I don't know if it's quite that easy to do with the UHF and VHF, because usually the bandwidth of those antennas are rather wide. So that saves us the trouble of having to buy an antenna tuner for those bands for the most part. So it would be probably a better thing to try and test out on an HF band, but it might add a little bit of information to the equation.
Yeah, copy that. Agree.
Hey, I believe that Todd had something else to say on the subject.
Quick follow-up. I convert all my radios to BNC so I can swap them on different antennas. The only one is my 900 megahertz. That I left as an SMA because, obviously, I'm not going to use that antenna on anything else. But in Brian's specific case, contact somebody at Fairlawn, and when you go to a meeting, while you're sitting there at the meeting, use their antenna analyzer, sweep each antenna, and you'll be done. And that way you get through some of the boring parts of the meeting. No, but then the other thing is, as far as using a tuner, VA trap and UA trap, no, you're not going to be able to do it by noise level. You're going to have to read the meter for the power output as well as the SWR to determine the best balance. That I know from personal experience, having used the VA-TREP, UA-TREP tuners. So I just wanted to point that out. On A-TREP, yes, you can tune in for the reception and be in the right, almost right on the ballpark, depending on how good your ears are. KD2-CBV.
Okay, so we're pretty much all in agreement, Brian. Any other comments about this or further questions on the subject or any other comments?
This is KD2KLN. Yeah, I'm going to, yeah, a lot of these antennas are, you know, generic from back in the day when probably a lot of them were purchased from Radio Shack and were actually for handheld CB radios. So, I mean, I've got one that's a collapsible with what looks like a center loading coil, you know, somewhere near the middle of the collapsible antenna. So it's like, yeah, so a lot of them, but also some of them are from like handheld scanners or something, so in which case those might be VHF, UHF antennas. Yeah, what I'm going to have to do is, take out a full day and borrow somebody's antenna scanner. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, like I said, using an SWR meter, I got hilarious results, mostly because when you're attaching a rubber duck or whip antenna to a SWR meter, you're, how can I describe this? You're no longer acting as the counterpoise. Your body is no longer acting as a counterpoise. So I was getting very extremely high SWR, even with radios that were designed for, 2 meter and 440. My meter was telling me all kinds of things, like these antennas were not meant for it to be used on a handheld amateur radio, because there was no counterpoise to them, your body is supposed to act like one when you're holding the radio, and in this case, I was not. So the antennas were not fully set up, essentially, and were reading as high SWR. So that's also something to take into account.
KD2NNZ, comment?
Yes, comment away, NNZ.
Roger. Brian, you can set up a counterpoise, I believe, with a small gauge wire of sufficient length for the frequency you want to check, and that would act as your counterpoise. I believe that would work. Anything on that, Roy?
Yes, I would agree also that the problem with all handy-talkie rubber duckies is that they all require a human body as a counterpoise. It's just the way they're designed. And so if you're not going to supply your body, you're going to have to supply a somewhat equivalent. And a length of wire will probably suffice and make it easier for you to get any kind of meaningful results on both the antenna analyzer and any other meter that you choose to use. Now, also, you could just use a measuring stick as well, because you have to realize that all these rubber duckies are at most a quarter wave verticals. Usually they're shortened with a loading coil someplace hidden inside their mechanism. And so obviously things that are longer than a quarter wavelength of the frequency that you're interested in is probably not going to be resonant to your frequency and was meant for, say, 10 meters or what have you. So there's a size range that you can probably take out of your pile. You know, these things that are collapsible, usually they're not for UHF, VHF, because you really don't need a collapsible antenna to be resonant for those frequencies. So that's a good way of kind of eyeballing whether you're dealing with an 11-meter rubber ducky.
Okie doke, I think we've covered this. Let's move on to the next subject.
Okay, Brian, I just wanted to make sure that that you got as much of an answer as we could provide tonight. Next on our list is Lloyd. Lloyd, what is your question for tonight?
Kilo 2, Japan Victor X-ray. Thank you, Roy. And also I'd like to thank everyone on the net for putting up with my machinations on Sunday when I tried to check into the 10-meter net, including the relay. I don't know, I think you were, I seem to recognize your voice, Roy. It was, you know, very difficult to get stuff above the noise level. And apparently my transmission was coming and going, but that was probably because I was fiddling with the tuner on my loop, which is very difficult. But this has nothing to do with my question. I just wanted to thank everyone. The question is this. And it's sort of a something completely different question. It's not so much a technical question as it is just a question of interest, and that is, and I do get asked this all the time, but what are the physiological effects of UHF at like 50 watts? And I know that, and being near, quote, near, whatever that means, near the antenna, and I was just checking the Arrow website because I was considering buying one of their satellite antennas, and this prompted me to think about this again. And it says if mounted and away from people, maximum power is 150 watts. And I don't know what they mean by away from people. And I was wondering if you're right on top of it or holding it and right behind it, so you're getting the back end of 150 watts at UHF. Is that really a problem? What happens to you exactly? So that's, I guess, my question. What are the immediate physiological effects? Back to net.
Okay, Lloyd. As far as when is close too close, it's a difficult problem. It has a lot to do with the amount of power that you're emitting. Because if you think about it, the closeness of a handy talkie, you're putting it right next to your face or a cell phone. You're putting it right up against your ear. So the radiation diminishes by the inverse square law. So you take it 1 foot away, it drops. You put it 2 feet away, now it drops by four times. You put it 10 feet away, now it's 1/100th the power. So if you get it more than 10, 15 feet away from you, unless you're running some ridiculous amount of power, it should be sufficient. So let me discuss ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, this is AC2GS, by the way. Radio frequencies are called non-ionizing radiation. That means that they do not rip electrons off of atoms. They simply make them jostle and jump around a bit like a Mexican jumping bean. And this is seen very easily in the average microwave oven. Water is a dipolar molecule. It has a positive end and a negative end. And if you stick it, if you stick water in a microwave and you expose it to a lot of RF, what you're doing is causing the molecules to jerk back and forth very rapidly. It adds kinetic energy, which is another way of saying temperature, and so the temperature goes up. You have to get all the way to the ultraviolet light spectrum in order to have ionizing radiation that causes the damage of sunburns, and then it gets worse in X-rays and gamma rays and such. So in radio frequencies, the only physiological change is producing heat. There are some areas of the body that are more sensitive to heat, and also most RF doesn't really go very deep inside. So the major risks most people are concerned with is increasing the temperature inside things like your eyeball. Whether that can lead to kind of a visual problem down the road is unclear. There are a lot of fear mongers about cell phones and cell phone towers, but there's nothing obvious at normal levels of regular UHF and VHF RF. If you come really close to an antenna, you can have what's called an electrical burn, which hurts like heck. But for that, you really have to be touching the darn thing to get an electrical burn. But for the most part, the problems are heating effects, and the eyeball is probably the most dangerous thing that you might overheat. Let me open it up to the rest of the guys if they have any comments or statements about this aspect of radio frequencies. And by the way, there is a gentleman out there, it was in the ARRL newsletter, I believe, who decided he was going to design a 900 megahertz RF transmitter to be worn on people's heads to decrease the risk of them going senile. So there's at least one guy who thinks that RF is beneficial. So once again, let me open it up to the rest of the people for any comment.
Kilo Golf to Charlie with one comment from me and one comment from my wife after that.
32 KLM with a comment.
Okay, we'll go with Milan and Mrs. Milan.
All right, thank you, Roy. So my comment was about the directionality of the antenna, because the antenna that Lloyd mentions, the arrow antennas, they are Yagis. So they have strong directional gain, and for those antennas, the direction really matters. For example, I wouldn't be so worried about using a bit more power if I'm standing on the side of the antenna, but I sure wouldn't want to use more power and be holding the antenna in my hand as this antenna is typically operated. And that's why they warn people, because typically you grab the antenna with one hand, you hold the radio with the other hand, and you operate like that. So it's no good to run 100 watts doing this. But some people just put them on top of the rooftop away from people and babies and things like that, and that's perfectly fine to run a lot of power as long as you're not going through the diplexer, which will fry at more than 10 watts. And this is even more true for even more directional antennas at higher frequencies, like many of the dish antennas that are being used for at 1.2 gigahertz and above at microwave frequencies, because you really don't want to be standing in front of those antennas. And with that, I will give it over to my wife for comments. Let me drop.
Kilo Delta 2, Mike Sierra Victor. I'm Milan's wife, Mrs. Milan, also known as Masha. So I'm currently getting my master's in physics, so I wanted to say a little bit about radiation. First off, the energy of photons is tied to their frequency, which is the inverse of their wavelength. That means that the higher the frequency, the more damaging the photons can be. And super low frequency photons just can't damage you at all, regardless of how many that you are exposed to. Also, I wanted to add a little bit about nuclear radiation. Nuclear radiation is actually three kinds of radioactive decay, alpha, beta, and gamma decay. Alpha decay is the safest. Actually, a sheet of paper can block it because it's composed of, I believe, two protons and two neutrons. So it's because it's so big, it can't really harm you unless you digest it, which I don't see why anyone would be in that situation. As for beta decay is electrons, and that can be harmful, but also it's pretty easily blocked. However, the most dangerous kind, and what we usually talk about when we talk about nuclear decay, is gamma decay. And gamma particles are basically very high-energy photons. So photons, the same thing that's causing EM radiation, electromagnetic radiation, however, at a much higher frequency than what we usually encounter in everyday life. This is Kilo Delta 2, Mike Sierra Victor.
Well, thank you very much for adding that. And there was cases back in the bad old days of they took to painting tritium and such on clocks, and the poor women would wet the wick with their tongue and then dip it into the tritium and paint the fine glowing figures. And although they didn't quite swallow the tritium, the alpha particles got into their oropharyngeal areas, and there was a lot of head and neck cancer among them. So, yes, it's when we're talking electromagnetic waves, it's principally X-rays, gamma rays that are very dangerous. Radio frequency waves can cook you, and any time that you've ever put anything in your microwave, that's self-evident. But, all things in moderation. I wouldn't be quite as worried as some of the people who want to disallow any cell towers from being built because of the fear of electromagnetism doing terrible things to their developing children and such. You know, paranoia is just a way of life among some people. Lloyd, I think you wanted to say something?
Yeah, well, I do have a comment. I think that the distinction between ionizing radiation and the fact that it can cause genetic mutations and so on and so forth, including and soft tissue damage, is pretty clear. But but in the case of UHF, high wattage UHF exposure, and its correlation with heat, I think is kind of interesting, because how hot is too hot, and when do you know? Can you actually feel your eyeballs starting to, your vision gets blurred, and you should move away from the, move away quickly from the RF source? Can you feel, can you feel your body getting warm? You know, this is what interests me, because how do you really, I had a lot, you know, if you're like, for example, right now I have one of those mag mounts on top of a dresser, and it's about 5 feet from where I'm transmitting, and I drop my power to 25 watts because that seems to open the repeater adequately. And the question is, if I'm, you know, on a prolonged conversation like I am now, hogging the mic, will this cause some kind of damage to me if I don't perceive it in the first instance? I once had a very long QSO with a guy in New Jersey who, you know, I told him I was hitting him at 50, at the repeater, I think it was the one in Fairlawn, at 50 watts, and he was like all freaked out and said, that's really dangerous. And I said, but it's not electromagnetic radiation, you know, he said, but still, you shouldn't do that, it's not good for you. And the question is, if you're not feeling, I guess my question is, coming back to what my first question was, what are the true physiological effects? If you don't feel anything, is it okay? Back to Ned.
AC2GS. Well, I'll offer you a definitive maybe. Electrical burns are incredibly obvious, and you know them immediately. Having the inside of your eyeball raised by a quarter of a degree Fahrenheit is a very subtle effect and of a very dubious whether it has any long-term risk. Again, there's nothing terribly useful in the experimental data to demonstrate it. There are guys, you have to realize, you know, high-power transmissions have been going on in the world for greater part of 100 years, and I can't recall a single incident of someone who had a long-term problem due to local exposure of RF fields. It's one of those things that sounds dangerous, might be somewhat dangerous, but there's very little to no proof about it. And it's not an obvious thing. You're not going to, unless you really stick your head in front of a Yagi, you're probably not going to notice anything, and you'll get that RF burn long before you'll feel your eyeballs heat up. So unfortunately, I wish I could tell you that it's not a subtle effect that you could feel in your bones or your eyeballs, but it is. It's very subtle.
You know, QSL. So, I guess, that is a good answer to my question, because I guess, so therefore, for example, like when you're in an automobile, though you're somewhat shielded from the RF by the metal roof of your car, so on and so forth, but in the case of like being close to your antenna when you're operating off a base station at an HT and you can go up to 50 watts, in some cases more if you had a UHF-VHF amplifier, it's not the end of the world, I guess. That's what we're saying here. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, you have more energy per watt in microwaves than UHF, and less in VHF and less in HF and such, and it goes down the road. But it's all heat energy until you get into the ultraviolet. And getting back on what Malen said about the directional antennas, as far as I've seen people who've used these portable Yagis, they're almost always pointing away from them, not pointing at them. So just kind of obvious things, don't point guns at yourself, don't point Yagis at yourself. And that probably goes for dish type of transmitter antennas as well. So, you know, be behind them, not in front of them, and if someone's behind you with one of those, make sure it's not pointed at you.
And I might add to that, don't point the Yagi at your friends, family, and strangers even.
Yes, you have, you know, I wouldn't treat it quite like a gun, but, you know, treat it with a little respect. If you're going to point it in the general direction of another human being, make sure that there's a nice distance between you and the other human being.
82 NNZ comment.
Kip? Yes, NNZ with a comment.
Okay. The FDNY uses a radio. It's basically a mobile radio in a Pelican box, and we use it for challenging communications areas, which you know we have in high-rises and tunnels and subways and such. That radio is a mobile radio operating at 45 watts. We advise our members to stay at least 2 feet away. Number two, I can guarantee you that if you touch the Omni antenna that's on the radio, that it will burn your fingers, because that has happened to me accidentally, but I can assure you that that will happen. That's basically it, and I've been wearing a radio on the side of my left side, pinched against my kidney for 30 years, operating at 5 watts at certain times. So I'll let you know how that works out. Back to the net.
2KLM with a comment.
Please give us your comment.
Hi, this is KD2KLM. There's a simple little circuit you can build called an RF detector. It's a great visual indicator of how quickly RF energy falls off. It's basically a germanium diode, two capacitors, and an LED, and you rig it together, and when you press your, you know, handy-talkie, and you press the push-to-talk button, it'll light up the LED, but only if you're, like, right next to the circuit. You walk 2 feet away, you press the push-to-talk button, and you get nothing out of the LED, and that's how quickly this stuff falls off.
Yes, it falls off as the inverse square law, as I mentioned before, and that's a very inexpensive, quick, and easy way of building a little detector. There are field strength detectors that are commercially available that you can buy that will give you specific amounts of numbers, and you can translate them into other units as your whim. The bottom line is electrical burns, RF burns, are the major danger that people have had happen to them. The slight increase in local surface temperature is a much vaguer kind of a concept that is more cautionary than it is anecdotal stories. There are very few people, well, I've never heard of anyone give me a story about how they cooked little surface parts of the surface of their skin other than just a regular RF burn. It's a subtle thing, but you don't take chances. And so I could certainly understand that if you told some guy that you were running a kilowatt into your vertical antenna and your vertical antenna was a foot away from you, he would be aghast. So anyone else have any comments, questions, or point of views of non-ionizing radiation, the joys and problems? I'm looking forward to see if that gentleman makes any money trying to sell it as an aid to senility. AC2GS. Okay, it seems like we've beaten the dead horse. I will ask if there's anyone out there who arrived late who has any questions or comments for the technical net tonight.
Expose the dead horse.
Okay, potato, potato. One more time, anyone have any further questions or comments for the technical net before we move on to the puzzle of this particular tech net?
Net control. Kilo Delta 2 Oscar Victor Mike, it's Axel.
Yes, hello Axel, how are you? Do you have any questions today to the tech net?
Yes, Roy, how are you? How are you tonight? I was doing this week research on different kind of coax cable for different kind of antennas and things. I thought that there's a difference how they build them up, quality, etc. So let's put away the quality, bad quality coax cable. Let's talk about proper, normal, like it should be, coax cable. We see that there's different standards, mills, whatever, for military, whatever. But there's also how they build them with aluminum inside, no aluminum inside, jacket, this and that. Some they don't put a cover at all inside, they just have the, what is it called, the
inside transfer, just very, very low amount of what is called the ground cover after the foam. My question is, I've seen and I read on the difference according to what kind of frequency you're going to use the coax, you should use different types of coax cable. And my question is exactly why. Why do we need, if the range goes up, a certain type of coax? And it's like for HF, they say you don't need those kind of coax cables. You're okay with a lower quality one or the lower specs one. Basically, on what is it based exactly? On the difference, on the frequencies, how do we put each kind of a coax for the user we're gonna give it. I don't know if I explained it. Back to you, Net Control, KD2OBM.
Comment? Yes, Milan, with your comment.
I just want to answer the question, if I may, unless you want to go first.
Feel free. If I have any other comments, I'll make them after you.
All right, thank you very much. This is Kilo to Charlie. Well, basically, when you consider your antenna system, the coax is part of that antenna system. And you have to figure out what your design goal is.
Milan, you cut out. This happened last week and the last time, and there was something a little wonky with your standing wave ratio. So check your connection, because you aren't transmitting right now.
Your rooftop or on top of a tower, you need flexible coaxial cables. Some of the low-loss coaxial very thick and not particularly flexible. So those are cases when you might tolerate more loss. Also, you need a lower loss cable if you have a long run. Some people, they're, you know, they have more property than we have here in New York, so they have their antenna, so they have 200-300 feet of coax before they reach that hill. So they would use something nicer, like LMR 400, even though on HF you typically might not need LMR 400 if your antenna system is matched to your transmission system. And that's the second point I want to make. You need that coax is rated at certain power handling capabilities with certain voltages that it can withstand. And the higher the SWR that you are experiencing, the more losses you will have on that coax. So that's enough. If you plan to have a mismatched antenna that you're tuning near your station and you have had SWR along the coax, you want better coax to minimize your losses, or you want ladder line, which also has very low losses with a high SWR. So those are reasons why you would want thicker coaxial cable. Now, if you have shorter runs, you can do with something, and you don't run a lot of power, RG8X is perfectly fine for HF, and even for VHF, and for patch cables at UHF frequencies. And if you want to spend a little more money, I think RG213 it's thicker, but it's still fairly flexible coaxial cable that I recommend, and you can get it from many suppliers with very, very good quality, actually. And it can handle a full legal limit on HF just fine. Let me know if this answers it, and I'm sure Roy will have many more comments, and I might even have a few more, because I feel I'm missing a few important points.
KD2OVM, we lost you in the beginning of the first, 30 seconds, you know. And also, I understand that for transmitting. What about for receiving? Is it as important for receiving, the same as transmitting? Back to you.
Hey, do you hear me now, first of all?
Yes, I hear you.
Now?
Yes.
That's because the losses would happen regardless of whether you're transmitting or receiving. Any mismatches in impedance, just the loss of the coax itself due to length, connectors, you know, everything has losses in the system. So good coax would be better on receive as well. That's why people who do EME and weak signal stuff and, you know, communicate with satellites and things like that, where you have weak signals, usually tend to go with very thick, very low loss coax. You know, they often go beyond LMR 400 and get into hard line even. So yes, the losses are important on receive as well. Let me drop. And since you mentioned that I got cut off at some point, I didn't hear exactly when. Let me quickly summarize. Basically, you have to think of the whole system and the additive losses along the coax and the adapters and the patch cables, and think about how much power you plan to run right now, how much power you might want to run in the future, how much money you're willing to spend on it, because the better the coax, the more costly it is. Think about where do you need flexible coax. I mean, my first station, when I started building it, I thought I'll just go with LMR 400 all the way. I have the money, why not do it? Well, it turns out when you frequently connect and disconnect things, LMR 400 connectors tend to fall off. So I switched to the more flexible RG213, and now I'm even switching some things to RG8X for the flexibility. So you have to consider this as well. Sometimes you would tolerate more loss because the more lossy cables are much more flexible and convenient, and you can bend them to a smaller radius, because the thicker the cable, the bigger the radius you will need to maintain, because you cannot do sharp bends in any coaxial cable. But you, the radius of the bend will be much smaller for thinner cables, so that's another consideration. And you just have to think about how much losses you're willing to tolerate in your whole antenna system between your transceiver and your antenna. And you have to think about the SWR that you're going to have, because the higher the SWR, the bigger the losses with lossier cables. So if you are going to have a mismatched antenna, you know, go even thicker coax or ladder line, which is also very good if you're going to be running into a situation where you frequently will have a high SWR.
KD2 OVM. It's interesting about the SWR, because one might think that that depends on the length of the antenna sometimes, and it's not related to the coax. And it's interesting how a coax can also affect the SWR and the transmission and everything else.
Melen, did you want to comment on Axel's comment?
It's interesting how the coax affects the losses, or I didn't quite get it, I think.
Axel, you want to restate the question for Melen?
Yes. It's interesting how the SWR is affected by the type of coax that one is using. Instead of being the antenna itself, one assumes that the SWR will be only the antenna, and one will modify the length of the antenna or something there. Like we see as an example, I've seen that people add what is called a washer on the base of the antenna to lengthen it up in order to increase or reduce SWR. I don't remember exactly what you cost. Adding washers, okay. Adding or extracting, you will modify the SWR. But one will think that it depends on the antenna itself, not the coax. And it's interesting to what you say, that SWR could be affected by the type of the coax. And back to you.
Well, I was actually making a different point, so let me, boss, comment on the point I was making and another good point that you're making. First, I'll go with SWR. Why is it important to have a lower loss coax when you have high SWR? The SWR ratio just measure has to do with the forward power that you are producing from your transceiver or amplifier and how much reflected power you're measuring either at your tuner or at your radio, typically, being reflected back. Now, if you that means you're reflecting a lot of power from the antenna, meaning your antenna is mismatched, and a lot of the power is coming back to your station. Well, when you put a tuner, which is typically what happens when you have a high SWR, you want to get as much power to the antenna, right? So if in that scenario, you want to be running lower loss coax because you don't want that power to be lost bouncing back and forth, basically. Now, that's not very scientifically accurate, but I think it would give you a good picture of what's going on. And the second comment, how SWR is affected by the coax, well, since it has, the coax is not going to change how much power you're pushing into it, but it is going to change how much power you're measuring back in your transceiver. Suppose you had a very lossy coax. Well, less power in that case is going to make it back from the antenna being reflected to your station. So you would have an artificially better SWR ratio than you would with a lower loss coax. And you might that might actually hide some problems along the line, but that energy would just be wasted as heat because it will be converted to heat. So again, to get a good idea of the true SWR, you need to be running either lower loss coax or ladder or window line, which are actually very good for those purposes. And I guess let me make a third point, but let me drop first. The third point is that different types of coax experience different losses as the SWR increases. If you look online, there are charts for loss per 100 feet for different types of coaxial cable. And those charts, all of them, assume a 1-to-1 SWR ratio. So if you change the SWR, things don't necessarily change linearly. Some types of coax will drastically get worse compared to other types of coax. So that's also a consideration, and it has to do with the different materials and design of the coaxial cable. That's just, the science behind it. Again, easiest way to deal with it is just to get the more expensive and thicker coaxial cable that you can pay for and physically fit in the space you have. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf 2 Charm.
AC2GS. Very good, Milan. Well, I will put in my 2 cents because I tend to always put in my 2 cents. Coaxial cables historically didn't really do much of anything until World War II. The military made a lot of it, bought a lot of it, and when the war was over, there was a heck of a lot of surplus coaxial cable, and if there's amateur radio operators like one thing, it's Army surplus. And so coax was born. Coaxial cables can come in different impedances, and some of you may have noticed that cable television seems to use something called 75-ohm impedance cables. And yet amateurs use 50 ohms, and you might ask, why the difference? Well, the problem is that different impedance cables have different optimum qualities. At 75 ohms, a coaxial cable is kind of passing about the most amount of power that it could possibly carry with the least amount of loss. So that's why 75 is so good, because in cable TV, they're really not interested in anything else but the amount of loss per 100 feet. In the cases of lower impedance, at around 35 ohms, it has the greatest amount of power-carrying capacity. So for a given length of coax, you can run more watts. So when they came up with what would be the proper impedance for amateur radio, they split the difference between the 30 ohms of maximum power capacity and the 75 ohms of minimum loss, and they came up with 50 ohms. So that's why we tend to use 50-ohm impedance coax cables. I know guys who get 75-ohm coaxial cables relatively cheap and use it, and it works for them. There are some mismatch problems, but they get around it. Let me drop. Okay, AC2GS once again. As far as coaxial cables, they come in different qualities, as you mentioned, and different thicknesses. Usually, all things being equal, as you make the thicknesses greater and greater,
You increase the power handling capacity, and you also decrease the power loss, which is usually measured in how many decibels of loss, which is a ratio per 100 feet, and it's related to frequency. You will have generally less loss for a low-frequency signal than you will for a high-frequency signal. And so that is why if you're handling HF, it's somewhat less important to worry about the loss of a coaxial cable. You pretty much just have to focus on the power handling capacity. If you're going to run 100 watts in HF, you need a lot less in the way of cable than if you're running, say, UHF at 1,000 watts. Also, it's not that the standing wave ratio is affected by different qualities of cables. It's that a standing wave ratio produces a certain degree of reflection of the signal back and forth. And the coaxial cable really doesn't care what direction the power is going. It's going to draw off some of it into thermal heat and loss no matter what direction. So if it's going in one single direction, it has a certain loss per 100 feet. But if it's going in both directions back and forth a few times, every trip it decreases a little bit with each trip. And that's why if you want something with less loss if you're going to have reflected signal. In fact, if you're talking about standing wave ratio as a match of impedance, coaxial cables can affect the impedance that is seen by your radio system from your antenna. If everything is lovely 50 ohms, if your antenna is 50 ohms, your coaxial cable is 50 ohms, then the length of the coaxial cable has no effect. But if you have an impedance mismatch of some kind along the way, as you change the length of the coaxial cable, you will actually rotate the impedance around a certain value in a Smith chart. And if you have nothing better to do someday, you should really look into Smith charts. They're rather fascinating things. But I have had experiences where my antenna tuner could not tune my antenna. I changed the length of the coaxial cable, which rotated the phase angle of the impedance, and put it in a range where my antenna tuner could, in fact, tune it. And so length does have an effect. It has an effect, once again, on the impedance, which leads to a standing wave ratio measurement. You could either do standing wave ratio as reflected forward versus reverse power, or you can discern it from the impedance mismatches involved. So standing wave ratio is, again, another interesting topic that I could go on and on about. But that's about my 2 cents worth. I like LMR 400. Some people like 213. 213 is partially ear core. It's a spiral helix of polyethylene plastic, but it does have spaces. So if you don't waterproof it correctly, you can get actually water into the insulating material, which will completely ruin it. Everyone has their favorites. Mine, as I said, are LMR 400, but a case can be made for pretty much any other brand. And as you get into narrower and narrower coaxial cables, they are much more flexible, much more easier to deal with, but they have issues of higher loss and such. And so, you know, there's lots of coaxial cable to choose from. Coaxial, do you think we answered your question? Is there any other aspect of this that concerns you?
Thank you so much, Roy and Milan. You clarified a lot, because when one is looking into those things, and it's a little confused. It's confusing. It's like swimming in the middle of the ocean. And one tries to Google and think here and there, and not all the ideas are so clear. One goes to the expert to ask the difference. And it's different to hear it from people and reading it. But one can bring the explanation based on the on some experience, right? Okay, so it's much more clear for me. And when I read about it, continuing my research, it will be much more full of information here in my head. Thank you so much, guys. Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Victor Mike.
Okay, Okay, very good, Axel. I always describe it like an onion skin. You peel away one onion, and it exposes another onion skin, and you peel that away, and there's another, and it's just an endless stream. So the deeper you get into these subjects, the more curious little aspects that you never even thought about jump at you. Like most people argue about whether there's an optimum length for transmission line. There's a lot of old tales out there, myths that they have to be multiples of a quarter wavelength in order to be useful, and other people who don't think that the length of a coaxial cable has any effect. And the trouble is always when it's kind of someplace in the middle. And so it's always interesting when you learn about the little subtleties as opposed to the cookbook answers that some of the guys give you on HF. Some of the guys on HF are great. They're brilliant. They have so much wisdom to give us. But every so often, there are guys out there that just kind of pass on things. They used to call it Chinese telephone, where someone would whisper something in one person's ear, and then they whisper it to the next person down the chain, and it would be completely confused by the time it got back to you. So be cautious about suggestions and comments of people. You pretty much should kind of aim towards consistency. When a whole bunch of people are telling you pretty much similar things, that's usually a good thing.
That is true.
So anyone else have any kind of comments or questions about transmission lines? Because transmission lines is, you know, next probably to grounding and antennas, are a subject that's near and dear to just about every amateur's heart. It makes or breaks a station.
No, it's true. It's true. There's a story behind all this. But I don't think it's the time right now. It could be after the next, maybe. Somebody wants to join. Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Victor Mike.
Okay, Axel. Once again, anyone out there have any comments or statements or opinions that they'd like to share about coaxial cables in general and transmission lines in general? Because it's a very big topic, but a very, very useful topic to know something about. Okay, it appears that we have beaten that one up also. So maybe next time or some later time there'll be some interesting questions about transmission lines. Before we get to the puzzle, once again, is there anyone who kind of arrived late or has thought up a question for the technical net tonight? Please give me your call sign.
Kilo Golf to Charlie with a comment on the coax question.
Yes, Milan.
Just wanted to add, when you do your research on coax, look up ladder line and window line. People seem to share a lot of myths about them online, and most of them come up remembering all the wrong stuff, it seems, at least when I read the stuff online, because people are a lot more afraid of using it because they think it interacts a lot with the metal around it. People would have you believe. You know, as long as you keep it reasonably away from any metal, then you don't run it side metal, it will be fine. I ran some window line from my rooftop along the house, just a foot or two away from the house. I pushed it away with a PVC pipe, and then through the window, I just closed the window on it, even though it's metal. It's a metal window. The window line was shielded, and that worked pretty well, actually. It did not lose power into the window, as far as I could tell. It was still very effective. And window line is great if you want to do a multi-band antennas, and you want to use one antenna on many frequencies, because you are probably not going to have an efficient antenna on all the bands in that case, and have a good SWR, but at least you will minimize your losses with the window line. So look that up when you're doing your research. Kilo Golf to Charlie, back to that.
Yes, I agree with Milan. Open line, which is straight two wires with a spreader between it, or window line, or the other variations have a great feature in that their power loss per 100 feet are lower than almost all the different coaxial cables of of incredible thickness and solid shields and such. So for a minimal price, you get something that has very little power loss. And that's why they're particularly good for non-resonant devices that are tuned on your side of the shack. Since it's impedance mismatched until it gets into your shack, there's going to be a lot of reflecting going on back and forth from what you're using as an antenna to your antenna tuner. So the less loss, the better. And again, open wire has the lowest loss that you can imagine. You got to be a little cautious. You got to keep it away from some metals. Some guys like to twist it with a certain helical spin to it. There's a little bit of an R to it, and you can foul it up, but it's not quite as sensitive as other people are afraid of. But I won't say it's been going through a renaissance. There are some people who like it, use it, and it works for them. Most people tend to, unfortunately, just rely on what they're used to, and that's coaxial cable. But open line, very nice technology.
JVX, final comment?
Yes, Lloyd.
I would just suggest to the listeners that if you do settle on a cable or want to experiment, it's extremely important, if not vital, to get the right stripping tool, because to try to do it with an X-Acto knife or manually is a complete nightmare, and you'll go through many feet of wasted line while you try to do that, whereas if you have the proper stripping tool for the matched to the coax, LMR-400 or whatever, you can strip it instantly and very accurately. Back to that.
Well, like anything, it depends upon how many hours you're used to using all this stuff. I know old-timers who sit there with a razor blade and can finesse stripping a coax faster than I can with my lovely little tool with built-in blades that are adjustable and what have you. I mean, I don't have the time to kind of build up my skill sets to be that good, but they do it, and they just kind of laugh at people who spend $40 for a tool to do it as well. But if you're not going to kind of dedicate your life to figuring out how to strip coaxial cables, these little tools are not terribly expensive and very, very useful. So I would agree with Lloyd there.
KD2OMG, KD2OMG, I have a comment.
Yes, OMG, comment away.
I've been reading about window line, and I'm pretty curious about it. What I don't understand is, why is it so different than twin lead?
It's not. It's simply the impedance of open lines are dependent upon the distance between the two. If you put them far away, if you put them close, the impedances shift. Twin line was 300 ohm. Ladder line is 450 ohm. There's a variation of ladder line that's 600 ohms. It's simply a matter of the distance between the two wires that you're using.
Comment?
Yes, Milan.
As Roy mentioned, the impedance is about the distance between the wires. It also has to do with the diameter of the wires. But the diameter of the wires is also important for the power handling capability, which is something as radio amateurs we care about. Twin lead is used on TVs where it was for receive only. It did not need to carry a whole lot of power. So if you're using it for 100 watts, you'll be fine. I'm not sure how well it will do with high power. I mean, you're welcome to try it. But the window lines that I buy... I buy mine from DX Engineering, but there's many other sources. For this, as far as I know, significantly sturdier than twin lead. It's not going to break easily. You know, it can withstand strong winds. It's quite sturdy, and it can handle legal limit with ease, even with high SWRs, because it's just a thicker stranded cable, and being stranded, I guess, helps also with breakages. Although I know you can buy it not in non-stranded variants as well, depending on your supplier.
Yeah, twin lead used to be very popular because it was all over the place, the same way that 75-ohm coaxial cable from cable TVs are all over the place. They had bales and bales of it in places like Radio Shack. Everyone and their mother had it. So it was a quick fix for many people back in the old days. It hasn't been used that much, at least that I'm aware of. So it doesn't have that ubiquitous quality that it once had. I would probably, if I was going to do open line, go with window pane or something a little more sturdy than twin lead. But twin lead if you got it and you want to try it, what the heck?
Great. Okay. Thank you for that.
Okay. Very good. Once again, does anyone have any questions or comments before we get to the puzzle of the week?
Here we'll go to Charlie with a comment on the crimping tools, the topic Lloyd kind of started.
Okay, very well, Milan. Comment away.
My recommendation, and it is certainly what I did, and I think you did the same thing, Roy, is to buy a crimping kit. Basically, rather than buy each tool individually and figure out what tool you need and pay a premium every time and pay shipping every time, is to buy one case tools that you will need. The most important tool actually has dies that you can change depending on what cable you are going to be crimping. So you need to get only one of those and several dies, and those kits have one of them and several dies, typically for LMR 400, RG213, RG8U, RG8X, whatever you can think of, and it's often even a power pole. So the one I got, I think I paid 120, 130 bucks or so. It included for all kinds of coaxial cables you can think of. It included dies for power poles, and it included two stripping tools, one for the thicker cable, like RG8U, LMR 400, RG213, and another one for the smaller gauge cable. I've used it only on RG8X so far, but I think it's usable for all of the TV type coaxes. What was RG6 or something like that? And it also has a very nice cable cutter, because you want to cut your cables to keep them round, because you don't want to squish them, because the squishing that dielectric will change your impedance, and you want to have a nice constant impedance along your cable with the connectors. And also has cutters for the center conductor, which you also want to trim neatly. And it has a screwdriver for changing the dies, because you screw the dies into the ratcheting tool. And if you do use that tool, don't hold it with two hands, just hold it with one hand and press it against a desk or a table. It makes it a lot easier and you don't have to use a lot of strength. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
AC2GS. Yeah, I agree with you entirely, Milan. I bought a kit as well. It's very useful to me. I really only use two die sets, and I kind of endlessly swap them in and out and in and out again. I use a lot of power poles, so I make them myself, and I use the die that has the coaxial connector crimping. And I'm a big fan of coax crimpers. There's a lot of old-timers who would very much look down upon me for that. If you can't solder it, what's the use of it? And yet, it's my experience that the industrial guys crimp it themselves. So if it's good enough for the industrial guys, as long as you use the proper tool and the proper technique, I haven't made a mess of it yet. So always read the instructions, look at the little YouTubes, but to me, it beats puttering around with a soldering iron and inevitably melting the insulation between the coax.
KD2OMG, comment?
Yes, OMG, comment away.
Was Malin suggesting a particular brand, or were you suggesting a particular product? I missed that.
I'll ask Milan if he wants to push his product. They sell a lot of these kits all over the place. They're not that rare. You can sort of tell a good one from a cheap thing. You know, if you're spending about 12 bucks for it, it's a cheap thing. If it doesn't have interchangeable dies, it's a cheap thing. But I really haven't heard of anyone getting burned with interchangeable die crimping tools. They tend to be of reasonably similar quality in my experience. Perhaps Milan has a different opinion.
Okay, we'll go through Charlie here. Well, the one I bought is from Quicksilver Radio. It's called the Ultimate Crimp Kit. I see right now they're selling it for 130. expensive, but they're therefore crimping other things. There are other similar kits. DX Engineering carries a similar kit that costs a lot more. So you can certainly spend more money than what I mentioned. If you look around in this as well, I'm mentioning this one because I have personally bought it and I'm happy with the quality of the kit. You can certainly, you know, buy them individually from places and maybe save some money by not having them in a nice carry case. But I kind of like the case because I can keep it in the garage when I don't use it. And when I need to crimp cables, I just get the case and everything is there. That's why I'm mentioning it. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to net.
Yeah, I believe for a while they were branding that crimper the Andy crimper. I'm not quite sure if there was an Andy involved or they just thought it was a clever name. By the way, Milan, unfortunately, you're kind of cutting out of the repeater every so often, off and on. So I don't know if it's the push-to-talk button or there's some other little loose connection someplace. But again, yeah, you can overpay anything, but I haven't seen anyone be burned by a really low-quality a die-in crimping set that just didn't work. So you got to work really hard to get cheated, at least these days, to my knowledge. So a Quicksilver is a great source of this type of equipment, and they have reasonable prices, and I have used them in the past. I get my power poles from them. So I feel fine in saying that you should look at their website and check them out.
Okay, thanks for that.
Roy, is the audio okay now? I wiggled the microphone connector a little bit.
Yes, you are solid 100% of that transmission. It was probably just it needed a little wiggling. Okay, I assume that there's nothing left in the manner of questions, but let me just ask one last time before we get to the puzzle. Anyone have any questions or comments for the technical net at this time? Okay, very well. So if anyone has had a chance to go to the website and looked at the webpage, again, puzzle.kc2rc.com, there is a nice little image of a printed circuit board and some copper foil pattern in the epoxy of the printed circuit board. And the question of the night is, what exactly is that darn thing? And you have four choices. Choice A is a copper snake. Choice B is a hairpin filter. Choice C is a bias T. And choice D is a copper T. So does anyone out there want to play a little game with me? Anyone have any suggestions what that picture is?
KG2OMG. I believe it's a hairpin filter.
Okay, very good. Anyone else with any opinions?
82NNC, I'm going to give a stab at it, Roy, and say it's a bias T.
Okay, anyone with any other opinions for tonight?
82OVM, can we add an E option?
We already have a D option. If you want, you can add an E option.
It looks like a Wi-Fi or Bluetooth antenna, just looking at it on a PC board.
Okay, it's sort of related. If it was an antenna, the contacts, though, would be connected to each other. Okay, let's go down the list of possibilities. The first choice was copper snake. Copper snake, unfortunately, is not a euphemism for anything electronic to my knowledge, but is a type of snake. So anyone out there who is interested in herpetology would sort of know that it's definitely not a biological snake, so it's not a copper snake. Hairpin filter, it looks like a very strong possibility, because basically a hairpin filter works on a principle that's very similar to something called strip line, which is printing in copper foil patterns on a printed circuit board in order to act as a discrete component. And that certainly is what that looks like to me. Now, choice C is a bias T. If anyone has seen a bias T, and I'm sure all of you have bias T circuits in a lot of your equipment, it's basically a RF DC diplexer. It's a means to put both a direct current and RF alternating current on the same exact line. You then tap off the DC with a RF choke, and you tap off the RF with a capacitive coupler. And so it looks like a T if you see the circuit, and if you follow up on the puzzle page in a half hour or so, I'll have a drawing of a bias T. It's a very nice circuit, but it doesn't look anything like that. A copper T, which is choice D, unless you've gone into the field of gynecology, you probably don't know what it is, or if you're a woman of a certain age, it was a intrauterine device to lessen the chances of pregnancy. Obviously, no one was going to use that pictured thing as a intrauterine device, so that's not it. So the best choice you got is a hairpin filter, and as was remarked earlier on the puzzle, he is quite right, it is a hairpin filter. Usually it is used for ultra-high frequencies and microwaves. It is used as a non-discrete component filter for those frequencies. Very interesting design. I don't know if I have any. Probably my Wi-Fi or someplace circuit has it, because it's the right frequency for that. So that's the puzzle for this time, and we'll have another puzzle for you next time, and we'll just keep throwing puzzles at you. So thanks a lot to everyone. Anyone have any questions or comments about this puzzle? Okay, very well. Does anyone have any questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight before we shut the place down?
One second, Roy. What is the function for this component in the PC board exactly?
It operates as a bandpass filter. Okay, once again, anyone have any other questions or comments before we end this edition of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net? Okay, you're going in and out, Milen, again, so it's time to wiggle that connector.
Okay, how about now?
Now you're fine.
I just wanted to mention, why does this thing exist? Why is it useful? Because obviously you could make a bandpass filter using a surface mount component. So why do this? Well, I'll give two reasons. First of all, often, you could just incorporate it as part of the printed design. So you don't have to do additional components. You're already paying for the printing of the board. And second reason, let's say you are experimenting and, you're building some component. In this case, I think this was taken out of a transverter for 1.2 gigahertz, if I remember correctly. Well, you might not be sure of the exact length that you will need for the filter. This filter, it's a very nice feature of it, that it's very easy to adapt to different frequencies. Basically, you can use the same width and distances between the elements of the filter and just correct the length, which is very easy. You just cut for the copper to the right length, and you keep measuring and cutting until your bandpass filter works for the bandwidth and frequencies that you want. So it's a very neat thing when you're experimenting and you're not sure exactly how things will turn out to be, which is kind of difficult to do with discrete components. I mean, you can calculate everything and hope for the best, but it's difficult to adjust things if you are wrong. And here, it's very easy to adjust things if you are wrong. So that's why it's so useful. Kilo to Charlie. Over to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Milen, for that excellent description, explanation. And it's, these strip line techniques and the hairpin filter techniques are very interesting. And if anyone has taken a gander into the components that make up their usual Wi-Fi router, they'll notice that things are a lot cleaner and smarter designed for UHF and microwave, because at these frequencies, strips of wire that are just strips of wire become inductors. Inductors become capacitive. Capacitors become inductive. And you have to really plan where you're going to put things, the length of things, where there's a ground plane, and there's a lot of extra engineering given to planning where the part should go. And if you put them in the wrong place and you don't care, then you have a design that really works awfully. There's a lot of noise, there's a lot of loss, there's a lot of nonsense, and you probably won't even get it passed from the FCC if you have to use it in a commercial piece of equipment. So, again, if you have nothing better to do someday and you YouTube RF circuit design, it's rather fascinating what these guys know and the little tricks of the trade that they use almost every day. So, once again, I will throw it out if anyone has any questions or comments regarding this technical net before we end it for tonight. Oh, very well. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, February 7th, sometime after 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join us. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on the Internet at fusion.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk a little less. But it's time to roll this all up and call it a day. We'll be back to do it all over again February 14th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Malen KG2C. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. This is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Bye, guys. See you next time.
Thank you, Roy, and to RGA. And just for information purposes, I've been working on the computer for the fusion streaming, and it looks like I just about got all the updates. Must be like 8 years of updates. But the laptop will be put back into service, and the streaming will be within 10 minutes to an hour. It'll be back online at fusion.kc2rc.com. And you can listen to the Fusion side of things 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a week, year. Thank you. And to RJ.
Okay, thank you very much, Mitch. And I will try and keep the analog stream live as much as I can. It's operating right now, and I'll just change the source a little bit after the net, but it should be live for the most part. I can't say 24/7, but I'll try and make it as close to that as possible. I have to point it in a different direction for our 10-meter net on Sunday mornings, because we also use the same stream for people to listen on our 10-meter net. But everyone's welcome to use the internet streams, listen on them for either the live.kc2rc analog stream or the FusionNet stream at Fusion. KC2RC.com, and we give you a nice selection on the internet, and you don't even have to have a radio. So tell your friends, tell your family, there's ways of listening that don't even require a Baofeng.
Thank you, Edward.
KD2NNZ clear. Good night, Roy. Nice job.
KD2OMG. Over. Thanks, Roy.